Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with University of Massachusetts at Lowell Professor Morgan Marietta and political strategist Jamie Burnett. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The House will try, once more, to pass a disaster relief package by unanimous consent on the heels of the week-long recess. Much like the last attempt, just one policymaker can derail the process by objecting to the $19 billion bill and blocking its passage. A freshman lawmaker did just that. The Senate had previously passed the measure 85-8. That freshman lawmaker said the package deserved a full House vote, should include humanitarian aid for migrants at the southern border, and should be paid for. Fellow lawmakers were displeased, deeming it a political stunt. While the disaster relief package is likely to become law in the coming weeks, it does not provide much confidence for the ongoing appropriations process for fiscal year 2020. Before additional money for the border will get broad support, policymakers will have to resolve a dispute over how much information must be shared between relief workers and the Department of Homeland Security. Humanitarian aid for migrants has been held up and not included in the current disaster aid package because some lawmakers want to prevent DHHS from having to share information about family members sponsoring unaccompanied migrant children who are held in custody. Democrats have sought language specifically barring such information sharing, except in cases where a potential sponsor has a history of violent crime or human trafficking violations. There is concern that fear of deportation could dissuade undocumented immigrants from sponsoring unaccompanied children, thereby increasing the number of children held in detention facilities. The president announced a planned second installment of agricultural aid to soften the blows brought by the trade war with China. About $14.5 billion of a $16 billion aid package would come in the form of direct payments to farmers. The rest would be used to purchase surplus agricultural products. Funding for the aid would come from the Commodity Credit Corporation, a Depression-era agency that provides farm price and income support payments. The agency borrows from the Treasury to finance its programs with an annual borrowing limit of $30 billion. It recoups borrowed money from the sale of commodity stocks, loan repayments, and fees, but that doesn't offset agency spending. Certain Medicaid programs could see funding shortfalls if Congress fails to act before September. Safety net hospitals that primarily serve low-income patients face a cut of $4 billion in fiscal year 2020. The cuts would double to $8 billion annually from fiscal year 2021 through 2025. House appropriators have asked the Justice Department to tighten regulations they said have allowed representatives of foreign countries to evade registering as foreign agents. The Appropriations Committee said it was concerned that foreign state-owned enterprises could avoid registering under the Foreign Agents Registration Act by using a commercial exemption. The committee directed the Justice Department to update its guidance governing registration requirements. Up next, Professor Morgan Marietta will join me to discuss dueling fact perceptions and how they can impact national policy. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by UMass Lowell Professor Morgan Marietta. Morgan is an associate professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. He is the author of four books, including his most recent, titled One Nation, Two Realities, Dueling Facts in American Democracy. He co-edits the Citizen Guides to Politics and Public Affairs, a series of books dedicated to explaining the core issues and institutions of American politics, and he co-edits an annual SCOTUS series on the major decisions of the Supreme Court. Morgan has a PhD from the University of Pittsburgh and a master's from Carnegie Mellon University. Welcome to Facing the Future, Morgan.
Hi, Chase. Thanks for having me on today.
I wanted to have you on the program to talk about some of your research and findings, especially around this topic of dueling fact perceptions. And what prompted this for me was an article that you had co-written with a gentleman named David Barker that talks a little bit about the Mueller report and the dueling facts associated with that. It was later reprinted in the Boston Globe for any of our listeners who might want to pick that up. And I think that might actually be a really good intro for this conversation. So maybe you can summarize for us what that particular article was trying to communicate and then some of the findings that you wove through.
Yeah, we originally hadn't been studying the Mueller report, but Dave and I started thinking about it, and we thought it was a perfect example of the book and all the research we started going back to 2010. That I'm sure all the listeners know that the reaction to the Mueller report was all over the map. And essentially people read it and believe whatever they wanted to believe about what it was saying. And we think that's a perfect example of what's been going on across American politics about dueling fact perceptions, that the Mueller report is a symptom of that, but it's also then one of the causes of that. It was almost written in a way that encourages people to project their own values, what they want to see, into what they read.
So what were some of the things that stood out to you specifically with the Mueller report that you highlighted in the article?
Well, what it came down to in the Mueller report was that trust is not there. That if you have someone like Mueller, who is the great expert on this, he's spent 2 years doing this, he's a very noted figure in this field as a prosecutor, and if he can't come to a clear conclusion about obstruction, then of course we have no one to trust. We don't have a sense of what we can know outside of our own perceptions. So one of the great problems of our current politics about dueling facts is that trust has fallen to such a degree because of political cultural polarization that if we don't trust universities, if we don't trust government, I was actually listening to an outtake on The View the other day. They had a congressman on, Dan Crenshaw, and he was citing some government statistics. And one of the interviewers said, "Oh, well, those are just government statistics. You know, we don't trust those. Those are just fake." And I was struck again by just how easily people discount things that we used to have trust in, what universities say, what government statistics say. And when that kind of trust isn't there.
I think that's an excellent point, Morgan. I mean, I'm reflecting back on my time in school, where all through college, all through law school, we're told to go to, you know, journals and, you know, substantive sources and avoid just Googling things to get facts and information. And now there's almost this shadow of doubt cast over even what have traditionally been viewed as a sound source or resource for information. One part of the article that stood out to me that you and David said was that you suspect that the Mueller report would have been rejected by about half the country, even if the conclusions had been definitive. But I was curious, do you think it would have been better if the report was actually more conclusive or more definitive on some of the points?
Well, I think anything that actually does inspire more trust in traditional sources of knowledge is a good thing. And I think the report could have been more clear in a way that ordinary people could understand. But yeah, we really do think even if it had done that, it still, in all likelihood, would have been rejected all the way around. And that really goes back to the point of the book and origins of this research. What happened was, this is Dave Barker, who I've been working with Dave for a long time, about 20 years now, on a lot of different projects. And around 2010, we started talking about this new phenomenon that we were perceiving, that there seemed to be more and more public disputes about facts. And it's not just climate change, the really obvious one, It's so many different things. It's about whether racism is really influential or not. It's about crime rates. It's about whether false convictions are really a very important and prevalent thing or not. It's about vaccines. It's about national debt. It's about the effects of immigration, effects of minimum wage, all sorts of things in our society. And we started to think that this was a new form of polarization, that it wasn't just polarization about party, about values, about media sources, about geography, that it was a second or third wave of polarization, of polarized perceptions of reality. And when we started looking into this, when we started collecting data on this, we started doing national surveys in 2013, and we started to see that there were these divided perceptions, and you could start plotting out the causes of this. You could see why people were so divided. And then what happened was the Trump campaign, and then a lot of scholars started working on this around 2016. Because, and this is one of the big points that we make in One Nation, Two Realities, that a lot of people now think that alternative facts, that it has to do with the Trump campaign. So they have a bit of an optimistic look about it, that they think it'll go away when we have a new president. And we don't think that's true. We think it started way before that. In some ways, the 2016 campaign expanded on it. But it's not about Trump, and it's not going away when Trump goes away. It's a pretty entrenched feature of our politics now.
Yeah, and I actually want to transition, Morgan, to your book, One Nation, Two Realities, because I think that was really the basis of the column that you and Dave wrote. But before we switch totally to the book, there was another part of the column that really stood out to me, and it spoke to that issue of values that you had just mentioned. And you said, you found that voters see the world in ways that reinforce their values and identities, irrespective of whether they have ever watched Fox News or MSNBC, and regardless of whether they have a Facebook account. And I'm curious, how did you come to make that conclusion that it's really just a way to reinforce?
Yeah, once we were sure that these divided perceptions really were real and prevalent, we wanted to understand the causes of it. We wanted eventually to get to the correctives of it, to see if there were ways that something could actually be done to arrive at consensus. But we thought you had to have a sense of the causes of it before you could really start thinking about how to correct it. And there were a few theories that were floating around. The biggest one was that it was partisanship, that people were simply being led by party leaders. They were being led by Sean Hannity on Fox. They were being led by Rachel Maddow on MSNBC. And they were really just cheerleading. They didn't really know what was true, so they were just going with their sports team, and they were just cheering for their side. And the other big theory on it is that it's really misinformation, which is to say that people are just hearing false things. So then if that's true, all you have to do is give them the right information. And when we started looking into this more deeply, we really found that both of those weren't true, that people do have access to the right information. It's not misinformation in the sense that you can just tell them what is accurate and they'll believe it. They're much more motivated than that. But they're not just motivated by party. If you measure people's partisan attachments and how much media consumption they have, but if you also measure their core values about whether they're really much more individualist, or they're much more collectivist, or they're much more secular, or they're much more theist, what you find is that it's actually driven by their values, much more than it is by media, much more than it is by partisanship, that people are looking at the world and they are not just asking themselves what's true, they're asking themselves what they want to be the case, and what their social groups want to see so that they can agree with the people around them. And it turns out that they are projecting their values into their perceptions. It's a fascinating concept that a lot of people just don't want to admit because they want to think that they're looking at all of this rationally. But there's a clear line between what people want to think exists in the world and what they see in the world.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Professor Morgan Marietta. We're discussing the dueling fact perceptions and how they can impact national policy. And Morgan, you mentioned that just providing correct or right information doesn't necessarily rectify this dueling fact issue. And you also mentioned that, you know, the value drives perception. So how do you actually bridge the dueling fact perception issue? Is there a way to actually do that?
I hate to be pessimistic for the audience out there, but what we found was that because the causes are so entrenched, that there are many different psychological mechanisms. The cognitive psychology ones that people selectively perceive, they selectively remember, they selectively accept evidence that is supporting what they want to believe, and they have this very high bar to accept the evidence that is opposed to it. And then all the social psychology involved, many, many different reinforcing psychologies that lead people to have these very entrenched views that are very difficult to correct. They're also much more certain. This is one that is remarkably important. The more extreme their value systems are, the more certain they are of their factual perceptions. And that's a fascinating one, because it's not so much the extremity of partisanship that's driving the certainty. It's the extremity of values that is driving the certainty. And what that means is that when you go to correctives, there are these two big correctives that people in different institutions have been trying to offer to reach consensus perceptions of facts. And the first one is fact-checking. And most of the studies on this have been demonstrating that while fact-checking has some good effects in terms of maybe encouraging politicians not to lie, it doesn't have strong effects at all in terms of changing people's perceptions of reality. The people who could benefit from fact-checking don't read them, and the people who do read them discount them because of the lack of trust that we've been talking about and all the psychologies of projection. So, no, they simply don't work. And then, I mean, people are really optimistic about it, but this is one thing that I should say, that if fact-checkers use their own methods, their own standards of fact-checking, whether fact-checking worked, they would agree that fact-checking does not work. There's a bit of bankruptcy in the institution there, that they won't fact-check their own institution. They pretend that it works, but the facts are that fact-checking doesn't work. And the other one that people don't want to admit within universities is about education. It turns out that the more educated people are, the better they are at projecting their values into their facts. They fall more deeply into the psychological mechanisms because they're more arrogant and they're more skilled. And it makes sense if you think about it. If you take somebody who's arrogant and skilled, they will see what they want to see. We tried really hard to give a more optimistic book. We really did, but we couldn't, not in any kind of honesty. We are cycling into more and more divided perception.
So I want to explore that for just a second. When you said you tried to give a more optimistic perspective or view of correcting this issue, what were some of the explanations you tried to explore or potential solutions, if any?
Yeah, it really is the education, whether higher education leads to it or whether fact-checking leads to it. Those are the big hitters. The other one, if you look at declining trust, trust in all sorts of institutions, universities, government, corporations, churches, all the social science research says that trust has been falling tremendously in the last decades. But we also don't know how to reinvigorate trust in that way. That might be the path forward on this.
Yeah, that was as soon as you said trust, and I thought in the back of my mind, well, how do you rebuild that trust, whether it's in the institution or the basis of facts or even looking beyond your own initial bias or perspective? How do we get to a point where our value system or our values that drive our perspective no longer cause us to distrust everything else?
That may be the great question about where our society is heading in the great polarization. I like to stick when I'm giving an opinion to something I know something about, and that one I don't. I think I'm the only hard thing I can say about my own abilities. Nobody else has an answer to that one either.
Yeah,
but that's the great question: is that declining trust in that way. But you know, let me say one thing though. There's a piece of research that I've been thinking about recently that I think is fascinating about this. Phil Tetlock, who I think is one of the great geniuses who studies this sort of thing. You might know Tetlock's work about expert political judgment, and he's been focusing on these forecasting tournaments recently. And he has this recent piece in Cognition that's just fascinating in the journal Cognition, that if you have people participate in forecasting tournaments, which means that they spend time over a protracted period, over weeks or a year, trying hard to get empirical reality right and to predict things accurately. And then they get constant feedback on whether they're right or not about predicting things. That actually does moderate their ideology. They become less ideological. They become less certain about things. And that's a really interesting concept, that if you can correct people or you can get them to think clearly about not just their opinions or not just trying to be clever, which is most people do most of the time, but about trying to be accurate, that can work.
But why does that environment create a more moderated or regulated sort of response or forecast? Is it simply because...
Yeah, we don't know yet. That's really interesting. I was just
so many questions.
So many questions. No, this is actually tip of the sword of a lot of fascinating research these days. I actually think there's two possibilities on it. One, I think if you have people regularly trying hard to predict reality rather than trying to be clever. You know, it's like the Fox News or the MSNBC line. They're just trying to one-up each other or be witty. And if you get people to actually place bets or they're trying to be accurate, they start to question their underlying premises of the world. And I suspect that might make them realize that there's some uncertainty about their premises of the world, or some of them might be wrong, and they start to moderate on them. And the other possibility is that people are very rarely corrected in our society. I think it's a real problem with higher education, by the way. I don't think we correct students nearly enough. I think they end up just thinking they're really smart by the time they're finished as undergraduates, but they've never gotten to the point of realizing that they aren't that smart or that other people also aren't that smart.
Well, it sounds like even if they got through college being corrected, their values might have driven them to disregard the correction.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's really, really, truly right. And if people are corrected pretty regularly, and they are told that they're wrong and believe it and can't just throw it off, I think that has an effect. I think it starts to make them less certain and more willing to look at things, and then they moderate about facts and value.
Sort of like a willingness to hedge your opinion if you're off balance or off kilter a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, but only if you can be pushed off kilter, and people generally aren't.
Right.
That looks onto something.
And I think I would love to continue talking about this for about another hour, but we're really running short on time, and I want to come sort of full circle to something you said earlier, and that was some research and analysis you had seen in relation to dueling fact perceptions and the national debt. I'm just curious, you know, what is it that you found, and you know, does it give us any hope as an organization like the Concord Coalition that works on fiscal policy?
Yeah, I know that your listeners are really particularly interested in this conception of national debt, and dueling fact perceptions of the debt. And there's a piece of good news for your listeners on this one, that a lot of dueling fact perceptions are pretty 50-50 or 60-40. True splits in our society, and that's definitely true of climate, racism, many different things. That is not true about the national debt. When we first started asking people questions of what they thought of the debt, and let me give your listeners some specifics on it, that 2013 we asked this question, is this statement certainly true, probably false, or certainly false? So you can get a sense of what people think, but also the range of certainty on it. The growing national debt is likely in the future to cripple economic growth and national security. Right? The proportion of people who said that was either probably true or certainly true is 78%. 43% thought it was certainly true. Only 22% thought it was either probably or certainly false.
Wow.
And so there is a real dominance on one side here. And what we started doing after that is... that's a one-sided statement, so there might be some acquiescence there of people saying it's true. We started giving either side and balancing it. In 2017, the most recent one we had, we changed the wording a little bit to see also if it's robust to changes in the phrasing. 2017, we asked a national sample of Americans this, is this probably certainly false, probably true, certainly true. Large amounts of national debt, like the U.S. currently has, eventually cause great harm to a nation's economy. And the other half got the opposite. Large amounts of national debt, like the U.S. currently has, do not necessarily cause great harm to a nation's economy. In 2017, 85% were on the side that it does actually cause harm.
Wow.
So national debt is a little different. It's a circumstance where the mass public has a decided view. It's not really a dueling fact perception. But elites are different. Elites actually do have a lot of division on this. And, you know, of course, that a lot of economists now are undertaking the MMT, modern monetary theory, and really arguing that the debt is not real in an important sense, and that it doesn't have negative consequences in the long term, and we can just print money. So there's an elite divide, but there's not a popular divide on it.
That's interesting. And I, again, I think we could go more in depth on that as well, but unfortunately we are out of time, and I for one appreciate the fact that you did ask that question of a sample of our population, and it's good to hear that at least there's a majority in recent years that believe the national debt can have some pretty negative consequences. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Professor Morgan Marietta. We've been discussing dueling fact perceptions, how they can impact national policy. Thank you for joining the show, Morgan.
Chase, thanks so much for having me on.
We'll be back after these short messages with policy and political strategist Jamie Burnett. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by policy and political strategist Jamie Burnett. Jamie is the president of Sightline Public Affairs, where he provides strategic consulting to industry-leading companies and trade groups engaged in public policy, representing them before the state's executive and legislative branches of government. He's also a UNH grad and serves on several boards, including as a trustee of the University System of New Hampshire. Thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Chase.
Well, happy to have you on Facing the Future, and I will, I guess, throw this out there for our listeners. Jamie is a good friend. One of the reasons why I wanted to have you on is not just because you work in public policy and strategic consulting, but you've got a pretty storied past. You've worked on campaigns and you've helped governors transition into office. So maybe before we talk about your day job, give a little summary of who you've worked for in terms of campaigning and what that was like.
Thanks. I've kind of throughout my career, and it's weird to say that because it's now been probably about 25 years I've been involved in politics. I'm aging here, but I've always had a foot in the legislative policymaking world, and for a long time had a foot in the political campaign world. Not so much in recent years. Probably my last foray into campaign politics was, at least directly, was in 2014. But I, you know, right out of graduate school, moved to Washington, D.C., and I started working in the U.S. Senate on the Hill for two senators from New Hampshire, first Jed Gregg and then John Sununu, the governor's older brother, not his father, and was involved in legislative work there, first as a legislative correspondent and assistant, which meant I answered a lot of mail and took a lot of meetings, and then with John Sununu as his legislative director, and got to run the legislative office in Washington for I was there for 4 years with him. So probably all in about 8 years in Washington. Had kids, got a little older, wanted to be back in New Hampshire, moved back, had a couple of different stints in Washington, but had worked on John Sununu's first Senate race, which he won. I had worked for Mitt Romney as his political director during his first run in 2008, and then again for John Sununu's reelect, which he did not win. And then since that time, I've been in an independent consulting practice for the last decade, and have done some campaign consulting at the gubernatorial level, congressional here. I also did some work in Rhode Island, and but mostly my work has and today exclusively is in public policy, government relations, sort of more generally public affairs strategies for companies that might intersect with the policymaking world or politics, and just try to help people do good things and make friends and not enemies, I guess. So
making friends is a good thing.
It is.
So going back to your time as a staffer in Washington and working on a campaign, how was the lifestyle different? Like, what was it like working in Capitol Hill and then being out on the trail with your candidate?
So I started on Capitol Hill when I was 26, and I'm 46 now. And so I'm older. I have two kids. So the lifestyle, particularly in terms of campaigning, but also Capitol Hill, you know, your work is a major focal point in your life, and the hours are difficult and they're long. It's exciting and it's fun. And I remember when I was younger and working in both of those environments that, you know, I liked working late. I liked working weekends. I liked working all the time. I mean, it's what you did, and it was enjoyable. And then, you know, when you, and not for everybody, and some people have been able to find this balance, but I think for me, I think it would have been difficult to find a balance that worked. But when I had kids, and particularly as I started getting a little older and a little bit more aware, it just felt much better to be around more. And so that's when my transition to consulting happened, where you could manage your workflow, manage your hours, and kind of build your work life around the needs that you have with your wife and your kids, and that's you know, meant a lot to me over the last many years. But it's a, you know, when I was working on the Hill and working in campaigns, you know, it's kind of what you read about and what you hear about. It's pretty fast paced. It's pretty nonstop. You know, and everybody's working a similar schedule. You know, it sometimes gets embellished or romanticized. I mean, I don't remember too many times where I was working, you know, 18, 19 hour days, as some people will talk about, where they're sleeping on the floor of a campaign office. And I remember, you know, I'm friends with people who actually have had those experiences, but you know, you work a lot. I mean, you know, you can work 100-hour work week, but you're just working all the time and you're always kind of on, you know, and you're traveling a lot throughout the state or wherever you might be. So, but it's exciting. You know, at some point we might talk about this more in terms of what younger professionals might think about in terms of getting into that field, or, you know, or what to prepare yourself for. But, you know, recently I remember going through an exercise on some work for clients and thinking that maybe everybody ought to at least do 1 year on a campaign, because it's a pretty good training ground, depending on how you approach it. You know, I mean, some people, I think, like campaigns because they want the fight. You know, they like the chess match, and you know, it's, and it, again, it's like they want what they've read about or seen in movies, yeah, which is a little embellished, but what's great about it, and what is good training for anything that you do, whether it's business or education or, you know, the nonprofit world, policymaking, is that you are exposed to a very wide range of people and personalities and issues and geography and generally just different constituencies. And, you know, and the same thing with Capitol Hill, by the way, when you're working for a member of Congress or the Senate. And it helps you, I think, to gain perspective, because not everybody, even in a small state like New Hampshire, thinks the same way. They don't have the same experiences. You know, there are regions of our state, certainly in the country, but regions of our state that are very distinct. And I think when you are able to understand people a little bit better, or at least understand that not everyone thinks exactly the way you do or the people you're working for do, it helps you in a lot of different areas, but certainly in the work that I do now for people, in trying to make the right connections, trying to build appropriate and productive partnerships with people. And it helps, I think, in any kind of collaboration that you might be doing, which is important in any of the work that we do.
So I want to go back to two things that you covered, and one was the sort of embellished versus reality of Capitol Hill or working on a campaign. And my wife and I have recently started rewatching The West Wing, which I think is a great show.
Yeah.
So I guess my question on the level of embellishment in terms of what it's like to actually do the work and Hollywood, you know, giving some version of that, is working on The Hill or on a campaign more closely related to The West Wing or House of Cards, or is it a totally different range?
Okay, that's a great question, only because people have asked me about this before and have told me what they think before. I remember working for a period of time with somebody who was new to a campaign, new to the campaign life here in this country. They were from another country, but started getting involved in American politics. And I remember one time this young guy telling me that what he liked about American politics is he thought it was exactly the way House of Cards played out, the American version, not the British version. And I looked at him and I said, you were absolutely wrong. I mean, first of all, people are not generally getting murdered in American politics.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. But spoiler alert. Right?
That was like the first season.
You might want to recut that part. But you know, and listen, I mean, it's also not like The West Wing, but I would tell you that, you know, I'll admit, popular or not, West Wing is one of my favorite shows of all time. Now, I was the West Wing premiered in 99, right when I was getting my start on the Hill. And it's not like it is and it is not like the way it is, say, in on Capitol Hill or in Washington, right? Washington politics. If it worked the way it did in real life, it would be boring and no one would watch it.
It would be C-SPAN.
You know, but what I like about it, and it's funny that you bring that up as an example, because I just got done binging the whole 7 years with my oldest daughter, who's not quite 13, who, despite my best advice, is like trying, you know, thinks politics is the greatest and wants to get involved, right? But as a career. But what I like about that show, and I think it's relevant today, is just that it's generally, you know, it's very positive, very hopeful. It has a message, but it's, you know, it's kind of kind and soft in its message. And despite the fact that everybody on the show, you know, is working for a Democratic president, there are very certain moments in the show where the writers have pitted staff against each other to talk both sides of an issue, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes in surprising ways, and so it's a great show that way. And but you know, in real life, there's some things that it captures, I think, pretty accurately, and then some things that it embellishes on, just because it just makes it more interesting. And I don't.
Well, I appreciated that a couple episodes were focused on budget policy and the federal budget deficit.
Yeah.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You're listening to me and political and policy strategist Jamie Burnett. We're discussing how fun it is to work in politics and some of the realities of it. And I want to piggyback off of you're watching The West Wing with your daughter.
Yeah.
And she has an interest in working in politics right now in this currently sort of divided environment where it seems very hostile. Would you recommend young people going into this arena right now?
Let me first say that one of the great things I think about politics and just civic engagement is that you can do it regardless of what your career is. So you don't have to have a career in politics or government to be involved in it, which is great. And that's kind of what I've encouraged and talked to my daughters about, is that, you know, you can explore anything you want for a job or a career and you could still be involved in this. And so I do think that the current tenor of politics, you know, the debates, I would say the polarization that we see in politics right now, is more reason to be involved than not, if you approach it the right way. And I don't mean the right way, meaning that if you approach it the way I think, you know, is right, or that, but issues aside, that if you are, you know, productive, if you are, I always say, whether you're running for office or you just want to work in government and politics, I mean, what we need more of and what we want are people who are honest, decent, and smart, right? The rest of it I can work with, you know, on either side. I mean, you and I might agree on issues, we might disagree on issues, but if you're a good person, if you're honest and you're smart, we can figure out a lot, you know? And there might be some things we got to set aside and we're not ever going to agree on, but we're not going to waste our time yelling at each other at the top of our lungs and getting nowhere on anything. And I think that we see more of that today, and I think there were a lot of reasons for that. But what we need, I think, is for more good, honest, smart people to be involved, whether they're working in it, whether they're just active in it, or whether they're running for office. The problem, though, is that the current environment, I think, discourages a lot of good people from running for office or getting involved, because they see it and they see that there's constant hostility. It's, you know, you're involved in very public life and there's a lot of attacks. And I think, you know, there are good people that can and you would want to run for office and hold office that are choosing otherwise because they don't want all the other things that come with it, which is usually a lot of negativity and a lot of attacks and a lot of hostility. And also, I think, you know, the people that would be really good at it are people that know how to compromise, know how to solve problems, know how to address issues, know how to build coalitions of support around things, but they look at Washington today or even state politics sometimes and they think, well, do I even have an ability to get anything done? And if you don't think you have an ability to get anything done, why would you at all want to welcome all the other negative aspects to it? So there's that catch 22. You need good people, but the good people don't want to do it. But yeah, I think right now it's when we need them most, and I try to encourage people to get involved and to just be positive, productive and realize that everybody's bringing a different set of views to the table, but you know, be willing to accept some differences and work through it.
And Jamie, you mentioned and sort of described the current situation, and you're effectively working in the current situation right now with your consulting firm. Yep. You've transitioned from helping people get elected to working for them once they're elected, and then recently you helped the governor transition to becoming elected, and the last 10 years or so you've been doing consulting or lobbying in a sense, the alternate perspective. So what's it like for you taking that perspective and helping clients navigate the current dynamic or the current situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I'm working with people, when I'm representing clients, when I'm advising clients, you know, I'm trying to find opportunities where people can collaborate, where you might find shared success, mutual success. I think those are moments where, you know, everybody wins. That doesn't mean that you're not principled or there aren't priorities that you need to advocate for or to protect. But whenever you can, you know, you can find opportunities where people are comfortable working with your client or with other people, that you need to try to seize on those. And so you spend time trying to identify that and create those. I think it's helpful to view lobbying, you know, government relations as your first task is providing factual information. You know, when I worked on the Hill and was being lobbied, the lobbyists that I respected the most and liked the most were the ones where I could sit across the table and say, okay, I hear what you're saying. Now tell me who's going to hate everything that you're saying. And some of them were really honest about it. I said, all right, here's the thing. These people don't like it for these reasons, and that's valid, but this isn't valid, and this is what you need. And, you know, and they would have a real honest conversation with you about it. I try to do that same thing. I think if you're in constant spin mode, it catches up to you. You know, and partly because when you're in a constant spin mode, whether you're lobbying or you're campaigning or whatever, you start to have a hard time over time figuring out what's real and what's not yourself. And if you don't approach an issue or a campaign with a realistic point of view, you're not going to make good judgments. You know, this isn't a lobbying example, but I'll give you an example. I mean, I've worked on a campaign before where, you know, we took a candidate to the North Country for the first time. And this is a campaign that went on for a year or more. And you know, we're in a small town north of the Notches that, you know, we had a midweek event in February. You know, and like 90
which people, is a great time to have an event.
No kidding, right? But like 90 people showed up at this event, and it was a great event. I mean, 90 people on like a Tuesday or a Wednesday night, February, early February, middle
upstate
winter.
Upstate New Hampshire.
You know, upstate New Hampshire, right? Upstate, yeah, North Country. And for someone that the people up there didn't really know, was a success, a huge success. And it was so successful that it was the kind of example of an event that you would refer to throughout the campaign to say, well, look at where we started and look where we come and blah, 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 blah. But there were people on the campaign that would retell that story. And every time they would retell that story, it was like, well, we had 90 people in February. And then like a few months later, it's like, you know, we had 150 people come out on a Tuesday night. And then at the end of the campaign, and I'm not kidding, it was like 600 people showed up at this event. And I'm like, you know, and I'm on this campaign. I'm thinking, wow, we are spinning this so hard. We're just believing our own spin now. Mm. So, you know, if we are like that, how clearly are we seeing the field of play, whether it's legislative or campaign or business? And what kind of judgments are we making on that if we're not really dealing with the facts anymore? So, you know, I believe, you know, with my clients and with anybody, I mean, I don't think people hire me to be a yes man. You know, I don't want to be argumentative with clients either. But I think that, you know, first and foremost, you want to deal with the facts and you want to tell people what's real and what's not, and then make your judgments going from there. And I think that the people that you're lobbying or you're advocating to want that as well.
I really want to make your tagline, Jamie Burnett, the non-spin doctor.
I hope so.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and political and policy strategist Jamie Burnett discuss what it's like to work in politics, reality versus perhaps some embellishment by Hollywood, and the fact that he would recommend still that up-and-coming generations remain involved. Thank you for joining the show, Jamie.
Thank you for having me.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.